They want me to get rid of my dog. Can they do that?
I'm being fined for leaving my garage door open too long.
What are covenants? Do I have any rights?
Help, I feel like I've left the American zone.
If you want the answers to those questions, join me, Sue Bartholomew, and my guests on The Commons every Saturday from 2 to 3 right here on WBR Fairfax Radio. We'll ask the experts and we'll untangle the truth about what's left of our property rights. On The Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory membership homeowners associations. Join us as we explore this relatively new world of controlled living, which includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes. Living in a common ownership development means giving up the American dream. It means giving up your constitutional rights and control over your most valuable asset, your home. Living in a homeowners association means leaving the American zone. This is On the Commons, and I am Sue Bartholomew. Joining me today is Carolyn Douglas. Now, for those of you who heard her the last time you were on, I promised you she'd be back. Carolyn is an attorney. She's written an amazing book called The Dark Side. She's the only person I know who writes by the pound. And the number of pages, 800 pages, 8 pounds. Carolyn, thank you so very much for being back with us today. I've been looking forward to having you again.
Shu, I had such a wonderful time last time and such great feedback. I really appreciate it. I wanted small correction. I used to practice law. I no longer practice law, but I write law books, lots of law books, not just the big heavy ones like this law treatise on judging. I used to write for some of the premier legal publishers on the planet, but since I've become a whistleblower, the consequences of that is that my writing, I think, has become much more energized and much more interesting, but it's not as popular with the powers that decide who buys law books. So it's a populist book. It's an expose, a whistleblowing book. It's also kind of like a first-year law course because it's designed for lay people to help them understand how the court system functions at the secret level, the quiet level. So it's like a first-year law student, only more of a renegade book.
So you mean we don't, everything that goes on in court is not there in front of us? So we can see
everything
it?
That goes on in court is below the scenes. You have the public picture that occurs, and I know a lot of your listeners, I think, end up going to court,
yeah.
And at some point in the proceedings, they end up representing themselves.
Yes.
There are attorneys out there, but I think the attorneys are much more likely to go to be hired by the associations because of the fees involved.
Yes.
And the process can be extended such a long time that it really becomes an economic challenge to stay involved in a lawsuit and not end up, you try to give up, but you can't walk away because you end up losing. You know, it's a place where American citizens get trapped, entrapped, ensnared. There's a peculiarity to being involved in a lawsuit, especially as a defendant. Where once you get into it, you can't get out of it. And I think it's important for average citizens to understand what they're getting into before they even start. I've always enjoyed writing, even when I wrote law treatises on family law. Lay people would buy them, not just judges and attorneys and not just the court system or the law libraries, but lay people would. And I enjoy working with lay people and talking to lay people. Like I said, I'm no longer an attorney. The bar and I reached a huge disagreement over whistleblowing is not a popular pastime within the court system.
I wonder why.
I'm not sure. Would
why,
you represent
why?
Any of your listeners or the majority of your listeners as people who are disgruntled or whistleblowing about a bad system?
I don't think they're disgruntled. That's how they're characterized by the industry, who says, oh, there's no problem, everything is hunky-dory, everybody's happy, except for these disgruntled homeowners. They must have done something wrong to deserve being fined and punished and all of that wonderful stuff. But no, I think if people are honest and fair and work together, I think we should all be able to get along. But there's so much corruption all over the place.
Well, the whole system is that it takes from individuals and makes a greater system and then subjugates the individuals to the greater power or the greater authority. And so what I try to teach in my writing is that it's important to go back and figure out whether that authority that's taking your rights and taking your power is a legitimate authority. Where did their grant of authority come from? How big is the grant of authority? Is it big enough, for example, to take away your constitutional rights? Does a community association have enough power? Is it within their purview? When they get together and have their meetings, are they really allowed to make a vote that would take away, for example, your right to speak out? First Amendment rights. It's first because it's most important, and that's a federal right. Do they have that kind of authority? And if the answer, Shu, you and I have talked about.
No.
I think it's a California case, isn't it?
I just was telling you before we went on the air about a California case that's going to be coming out. We're going to be hearing a little bit more about it. But a woman, there was a bill pending in the legislature last year. I don't know whether it passed or not, but one of the homeowners went around to her neighbors and said, guess what? There's a bill here that would take away your voting rights in the association. Now, you know, if we talk about a democracy, voting is a cornerstone of that. And to take that away would just totally eliminate everything that's supposedly so wonderful about being in an HOA. And the board didn't like it. So they actually fined
her. They didn't like the bill or they didn't like the woman?
They didn't like the fact that the woman was talking to her neighbors and saying, hey, this bill's going through the legislature. You'd better call your congressman, your senator, and ask them to vote no on this bill, because if it passes, here's what it will do. And the board decided that that was against their best interest, never mind that they might just be a homeowner the following year and subject to these stupid rules. But so they fined her $500 for even talking to her neighbors about a bill that was going to harm them.
And my question to you is, what happened to the First Amendment? Was this a California bill? California has this interesting system of referendum. I went to law school in California, and citizens with a certain number of signatures, petitions or signatures, I think it was only in the thousands, 25,000, whatever, they could actually get something on the state ballot, and then everybody would vote. And what happens is it moves by populist movement and emotion, and the three strikes you're out law came out 20 years ago, first in California, and nobody had done any longitudinal studies or sociological studies to see what the impact really was. And the impact over the long term is so bad that they actually rescinded the law, because it's an emotional type of thing. But I could see California having a bill where they want to strip individual citizens of the right to free speech. And because I used to formerly draft bills for the legislature, I mean, I have to put on my little objection cap and say, wow, who are you? Even if you're the state of California, who do you think you are that you can violate the U.S. Constitution, you know, the fundamental rights that apply to everybody, and fine me if I decide I want to speak out? Of course, you know, I lost this battle in my state when I criticized judges and the Bar Association for their close affiliations with each other, that I think impacted on case outcomes. So you're speaking to a contrarian thinker who...
Hey, I like contrarians. They're my favorite people.
Who sees quite clearly that if California wants to pass a bill that says, I'm fining you $500 if you talk, I mean, where do we stop?
Okay, let me...
$500 if you talk about this topic or that topic or that topic. It's not just to homeowners. I mean, it seems blatantly unconstitutional, and everybody's going to go through this expensive exercise of gathering signatures and putting it on the ballot and having a statewide vote, and then somebody else is going to have to come along and bring a case that challenges it, and they may or may not lose in the Ninth Circuit, the federal court, and they might have to take it up to the Supreme Court. So you know what? We could all generate this massive legal bill of millions of dollars for challenging a law that probably never should have been on the ballot in the first place. So I understand that California then, they have a referendum for a second bill on the same topic, and it's the opposite. Is that right?
Well, there's another bill going through, and I don't know exactly what the thing is, but this particular incident generated some interest, but it's not the state of California that's fining this woman $500. It's the homeowners association that has been empowered to fine people for violating rules. And it's
that weren't even made at the time, probably, when this woman joined.
There probably isn't a rule anyway. There probably is not a rule anyway.
Oh, so it's the waving the magic wand kind of litigation.
I'm guessing that.
I think they call that the 3,000-pound gorilla rule enforcement.
I think that's what it is. I don't, I haven't read the case. I don't know exactly what it says. Carolyn, there's so many stupid things going on across the country. I just cannot keep track of everything, and I cannot keep on top of everything.
Well, and in a way, when I hear these stories, and I hear them every day, but in different arenas,
yes,
all over the country,
yes,
people who feel that their fundamental rights have been violated by some 3,000-pound gorilla wearing a different suit. So sometimes the gorilla wears a black robe, sometimes they wear a business suit, sometimes they're a corporation, or they are law enforcement, perhaps, or a prosecutor. All of those things, when we talk about challenging authority, I think it's really important to dig backwards in time. If you're a legal researcher and your weapons are looking up law and writing briefs, I end up tracing cases like a daisy chain. So I'll look at whatever this current bill is, and then I'll look at the legislative history, and then I'll go back and look at the cases before that and the ones that happened 10 years ago, and I'll trace it all the way back to the time California became a state to see where they think their authority comes from, that they can require a whole class of people to forego fundamental federal rights. And by doing that kind of research, it empowers me to make challenges. Because so often what I find is people in authority, whether it's an HOA board or whether it is the secret federal surveillance court, that people who are appointed, whether the president appoints you or whether the governor appoints you or whether your next-door neighbors appoint you, to be in charge, is that power goes to people's heads.
Yes.
We used to call it, when people would get elected to Congress, we used to say they had Potomac fever. Because what happens is congressmen or senators, when they're newly elected, they cross over the river, the one that George Washington went over.
Yeah.
They cross over the Potomac, and they get the fever. And the fever just gives them brain swell, head swell, until they believe that we are the chosen class, which is above the law, and somehow we are more empowered to make rules and limitations on our neighbors that probably don't apply to us. So I call that kind of imperial thinking Potomac fever.
You know,
and I'm in D.C., and it's kind of an internal joke that maybe the people in California wouldn't understand, but sometimes when you hear these egregious stories over and over and over again and they fall into patterns, in addition to fighting, you develop a sense of humor that's almost like a emergency room humor. You know, it almost has a macabre, humorous aspect, and it keeps us sane.
Well, we have an industry that feeds off it. I don't know how many billions of dollars annually, 90 plus billions of dollars. And they are always going to the legislature with their wish list. And the legislature will take a martini or, you know, some canapes and say, oh, yeah, anything you want, we'll do it. So they come up.
There's kind of a mentality in government, I think, which is that you have to spend up your entire allotment, and that every
yes.
year you're supposed to get at least a COLA increase.
Yes.
You're supposed to get some kind of an increase so that the budget always grows and grows and grows and grows. And what was so interesting, I remember when my ex was in Congress, is the balanced budget amendment was huge back then. It failed, and I've always kind of wondered if it shouldn't be a constitutional amendment. Haven't had a constitutional amendment in a lot of decades now, but I think it's something that as Americans perhaps we might consider, especially as we look at what's happening or what has already happened to the middle class in America, because it's certainly not getting a COLA or an increase or a growth every year.
No, it's not.
Expanding. In fact, it seems to be under siege from a variety of bureaucracies,
mm-hmm.
and HOAs are only one of those. I mean, 100 years ago, nobody had ever heard of an HOA.
50 years ago, nobody had ever heard of an HOA.
When was the first one? Do you know, Shu?
It was in the 70s, early 70s.
What city?
Well, actually, I'm going to go back. There were some before, but the mass-produced ones were in the early 70s. I think back in the 1800s, there were a handful of them, and these were put together by the owners over there. They were exclusionary. They wanted to keep a certain standard in their association, and they got together and they did that. But it was, you know, it was done by the homeowners. Now you have municipal mandates. And starting in the 70s, late 60s, early 70s, just about everything that's been built has been built in an HOA. So people have their rights to live freely have been usurped by local municipal governments who want to collect all this free tax dollars and not provide you with any services.
Yeah, I think the local governments are probably looking at avoiding having to do things like road repair or ordinary services that they give to people who live in single-family homes or apartment buildings or, you know, gosh,
street lights, trash removal, snow removal, street repair, you know, anything that the tax dollars, the property tax dollars were initially designed to pay for. Now they say, oh, well, we need that. We are so squeezed
broke.
For money.
They're so broke. Stakes are saying that.
Yeah.
In New Mexico is amazingly underwater. They are having this enormous broken financial system. Although I recently went back and looked at that state budget to see how many years in a row that they had increased, and what the percentages were. So the cutbacks that are coming this year probably put it back to about the 2012 range. And yet everyone is feeling incredibly deprived because there was a period of just unlimited expansion, government spending expansion. There's also this tossing aside responsibilities that used to belong to the government that we expect would be government, and now they're making them privately
yes.
incurred.
Yes.
Where else have I seen this recently? Oh, prisons. The whole idea that prisons should be all privatized and should be run by private corporations. where
who's
going to
pay for it?
Them,
who's going to pay for it?
Ownership in them is questionable, and the whole system is questionable, but everything is done by a series of private corporations that are interlocking. But if it comes time to sue them because there's some kind of wrong, everyone can evade responsibility. It's an outgrowth of what happened to the burgeoning of regulation in the 1980s in America. It was like the country just took off in terms of making new organizations and new limitations on licensing and code enforcement, for example, even building code enforcement. So it may give us the safest, maybe, perhaps I shouldn't say that, it gives us a safe place to live, but it also gives us a building cost per square foot that's so high that the rest of the world would shudder to have that kind of building cost for something as basic as living accommodations.
I don't think it makes it safer. That's one of the lies that's told to entice people to buy into it. It also says that it's going to protect your property values. It doesn't. The whole thing is built on a lie.
And so who benefits from this kind of...
Who benefits? I'll tell you who benefits. The local municipal government. Because if you look around you, you will see that the density has been increasing 100-fold. They've taken these little old houses on a quarter to a third to a half an acre, and they've just demolished them, and they've built up these humongously expensive condos, townhouses, high-rises, all of that, all made out of cardboard and scotch tape. The value of these things have grown exponentially because people have been buying them, and the tax, your municipal taxes are based on the value of the property. So if you have a little cardboard box that's worth $800,000 that's replaced maybe a single-family home on a bigger plot of land that wasn't worth that much, you do the math. You do the math. If you take...
And so you're looking at a density where they're taking down structures that may have housed three families and putting up structures that house 600 families.
That's basically. But the thing is,
200 families.
But the thing is, the structures are not, they're not as big. They're not as, or maybe they are as big, but they grow up. They're vertical instead of horizontal, and then they can just collect all this money. But they don't provide you with anything. I mean, you still have to pay for trash removal, snow removal, repairs to the buildings, sidewalks, streets, the whole lot. Everything is added to that. But the government is just taxing you at these phenomenal rates. What they're doing is building, at least in Fairfax County, they're building themselves huge Taj Mahals to house every agency within the government. They're giving themselves 20% pay raises when their constituents have not had a pay raise and, in fact, are making less than they were 20 years ago.
You know you're describing bloated bureaucracy. You know that, right?
Yes, I do know that. Well, how do I get this image into other people's heads?
Well, and then the bigger policy question behind it, as individual citizens, what is it that we can do to halt or reverse this enormous growth in bureaucracy, which we are now finding as a side effect,
but there's more,
limiting our rights.
But there's more of us, Carolyn, there's more of us than there is of them. And if we stop buying and believing all of this nonsense and start looking at things for what they really are and standing up to it and saying, stop, I've had enough. I'm not going to do it anymore.
Well,
we can't let them keep getting away with it.
And yet, as an individual person, what can we do about it? Let's say you are that lady that was fined $500. Now, I think you and I have both talked to another disgruntled lady recently that was in a different state. I think it was Arizona, Colorado, somewhere else. And the lady there was fined and jailed for walking her dog on her property, which was part of a homeowners association, but these were individual houses, expensive individual houses. And she was on her own property, but the president of the homeowners association felt that she was violating the law and there was a feud. And he called the police and they handcuffed her and arrested her overnight.
Yeah. No, it happens
for walking her dog on her own driveway. That's been a federal civil rights lawsuit. She's been unable, she's out, has been out, but can't stop talking about it. It's been several years. And the trauma of it and the anger over what she ended up being in this homeowners association has so angered her that we're talking about, you know, an outgrowth where there was a whole system, not just the president of the association, which is an individual, not just the arresting police officer, who's an individual, but then you get into the jail system, and then you get into the court system. Her particular grievance is with the judge. And personally, I find that my beef is with the judges, because I think that they hold power, which is independent power from the abuses that happen in law enforcement. Their power allows them to correct things. If they listen, they have independent power from every other branch of government, so that woman wouldn't have to go put in a referendum bill if she were in California, or contact all of her state senators to try to put in a bill to prevent this from happening to other people. So she's trying to stem that, and she's in the same position that many other homeowners association owners are in, which is she can't sell. She's unable for a variety of reasons, and it goes to the fines that they began assessing her. So although she ended up getting out of jail, she still has the fine, which was heard and tacked on another fine, and then it increases exponentially until they put a lien on her house.
Karen, they've got these powers that are unbelievable. I was
told like they're rampant and they're out of control, but individually,
they are.
You sue in court and you're unable to get a hearing. You're unable to have a fair hearing. You can try to sue the judge who upheld the false arrest, but you fail at that. You're denied that and your case is thrown out. So where do you go? What do you do?
You know, I was told, I mean, I hear from a lot of people, as you might imagine, and I hear these stories. I was told by someone that his wife was fined because she walked their dog too slowly across their driveway.
Ooh.
Their private driveway, and they decided that they were walking the dog too slowly. And so she was fined. I mean, where do these people come up with this stuff? How stupid. How incredibly stupid. But that's the kind of blatant abuse that's going on out there.
Well, it speaks to a bigger problem in American society, which is this hostility and aggressiveness and judging our neighbors, the lack of love, the lack of tolerance. And forgiveness. A lot of it, I think, ends up in this firefight of litigation where people are quick to sue their neighbors instead of trying to work things out. But it's a social intolerance, and it has roots that I think are about 50 years deep. It has sociological roots that are being studied. I'm not sure that you and I can resolve this.
But we have to talk about it, and the reason we have to talk about it is...
That's why we talk about it. That's why we try to point it out and to say maybe text messaging everybody about your complaint and not picking up the phone or not walking over and talking things through. I personally believe and practice mediation, neighborhood mediation, mediation for divorcing families, mediation for child custody disputes, mediation for car disputes, mediation for almost everything. And I think that there's a place for it, because what I found is that courts are inefficient and courts don't work, especially when we have this growth of enormous corporations which hide their individual meanness and petty acts and their greed as individuals behind an artificial legal entity. And they're so big. They've become so big in this century or century and 20 years that they've been in existence in America that as individuals, we're powerless to fight against them. You want to be that little farmer whose Monsanto corn seed blew into his field and you want to fight Monsanto when they sue you? I mean, that was a disaster. That was an unmitigated disaster. I do think there's a backlash in the middle class in America, and it's coming out of frustration and the inability to get relief anywhere or effective relief anywhere. I think we are at a point of change in America where individual people are turning away from not only the court system or trying to rely on the court system. There's a discouragement about what happens. You can't just go to court by yourself anymore. It takes a lot of money. As a matter of fact, it might take, if you're going through divorce, it can take your entire savings. It can take your whole lifetime of work. And you see that and multiply it times 10,000 people in every state.
There's a lot of money there.
Well, and it's the same thing with HOAs. If you look at what's happening behind that, is we have someone who's developing this. There is an incentive to develop it. So I would encourage people, if you're looking at doing a piece of legislation and you want your state to pass a piece of legislation, take it deeper than just trying to legislate individual behavior. Saying you can't violate First Amendment rights is one thing, but let's go back and look even further than that. What about this whole idea that the government can be relieved of the responsibilities of supporting citizens? I mean, governments are here to put in sewers and to maintain sidewalks and to do health and safety regulations and to put up a police force. And so here you end up privatizing it.
Yeah.
So it's gone to individual developers who want to trade the right to put in this kind of high-density process, system, and then walk away from it and leave it to be, quote, self-regulating when individual people across the country are indicating that they're not, they might be elected to a homeowners board, but they are not qualified to regulate the rights of all other human beings. And they're failing in those rights. So instead of looking at little solutions, I'd like to back up and see if we can't find a bigger solution to the whole idea. Is there any conference? Is there any annual conference on this whole homeowner development?
Oh, there is by the industry, and they, you know, it's all ha ha ha. Everybody's so happy with the whole thing. It's all a bunch of lies. Trying to organize the homeowners has been like herding cats, because everybody sees it. Well, everybody sees it from their own point of view. Everybody sees it as whatever their problem is. But
yeah, and they wait to approach the problem until they are each individually harmed.
Yeah, and to them
and
it would be okay.
What you listen to when I listen to complaints, and I'm sure when you do too, and you must have many more than I do, but when people contact you to see if you can help or if you can give relief, what you end up listening to is individual problems, which are long and tedious to listen to and define and to try to extrapolate the problem, which is why I would suggest backing up and looking at this from a policy point of view. I wish you'd run for office, Sue. I swear, I think I say that every time we speak.
I don't think I have my husband's support. I went through the ladder at Toastmasters, and I was gone the whole time, and he just, you know, he was, thank God that's over with. People say you're going to run for Toastmasters International, and he says no.
I do admit it is a job, and it is a challenge, and being in the public eye, But I think that there are certain people who are born with the ability and the tolerance to not only listen to a problem, but to extrapolate a more universal solution. And I would try to back this up all the way to the beginning of those first homeowners associations and then follow the evolution of it. I do believe that it follows the American chain, which is the development of corporations and organizations. And I question whether that was the right decision when it was made in the 1870s by the court system to consider a corporation to have the same rights as a human being, as a person. Now, people may say, right, Carolyn Douglas, you're going to try to overturn all those years of law that say a corporation is a person. But the fact that corporations are allowed to perpetrate so many injustices and get away with it and not be held responsible. So the people behind the veil, it's like the yellow brick road. You know, it's like Dorothy. You've got this little man behind the curtain manipulating all of this stuff.
Yeah.
And we as individuals,
yeah,
as citizens, as the general population, end up being intimidated and cowed and frightened until we're forced to stand up, until we're forced to take a stand because it's on our doorstep. And then being in a state of confusion for probably 2 or 3 or 4 years while a lawsuit is pending or while you're being fined or while you're challenging and doing the same problems that homeowners all across the country are doing, each in their own little spheres. So I think it's only by connecting and by finding out that you're not alone and then actually meeting and trying to figure out the solution. That's why this show on the Common, I think, is so important as a vehicle for letting people know that they're not alone and that it is a much, much bigger problem than that $500 fine, which is now turned into a $25,000 fine after 2 years of wrangling with your board. It's not enough to say, hey, don't buy into these associations.
You don't have a choice. You don't have a choice. And the thing is, buying a house is an emotional purchase. You don't go in there kicking the tires. You go in there and you fall in love with the view and the smell of the brownies baking in the oven. I mean, realtors know what they're doing when they stage these places. And people fall in love and they think, oh, well, it's not going to harm me. I won't do anything. I am a good person. Don't believe it.
How many times have we said that? I think the last speech I gave a speech in Congress a couple of weeks ago at the House of Representatives, and I started out by saying, I'm a Girl Scout. How could this happen to me? You're looking at the Girl Scout, the original brownie.
There you go. There you go.
We all think of ourselves as good citizens and good Americans.
And
we say, how
has
America gotten into this position where it's picking us off one at a time? It's taking our livelihood through a process, which is my subject, a process of court corruption that renders a result which is not only unfair but horrendously expensive and often has a zero-sum gain. It's not a win-win for anybody. It's always 100% and 0% outcome. And I write about a lot of those. That's one of the reasons that I wrote this book, was I wanted to convince people that they're not alone when they experience that. And because it's wrong, and because now, because I'm not an attorney, I have my First Amendment rights. As an attorney, I had no First Amendment rights. I could not criticize judges or the system without incurring an awful lot of professional conduct complaints.
So you
and
gave up your
retaliatory
rights.
Retaliatory lawsuits. They were enormous. There was an avalanche of them, and I lived under them for 10, almost 15 years. And then when I finally got out of that, I said, I'm through with this. I'm going to exercise my own First Amendment rights and say what needs to be said in an industry that's fearful of looking at itself and fearful of looking at what it has evolved into. Shu, I would encourage you to take this show on the road and to do interviews at the next HOA national conference, to set up a booth and do interviews and call people out and look for policy changes and look at a higher level for people willing to say, you know what, this has gotten off on the wrong track. How do we fix it?
I've had people from CAI on. They won't come on anymore. I've had them on, and privately, when I turn the mics off, they agree with me. But publicly, they're all stuck together like glue. You know, they're going to come up with the same nonsense.
I found that when I was actively whistleblowing in New Hampshire, I found that state legislators and other attorneys would come up to me, and sometimes they'd whisper and sometimes they'd motion me around the corner and say, I can't be seen with you. Over and over, one attorney kept saying it again. You're a hero. You're Joan of Arc, but you're radioactive. I can't be seen with you. And another, when I tried to hire him to represent me in one of the cases, he said, you deserve it. You need this. But I'm a two-person law firm, and they will retaliate against me if I defend you.
Oh, yeah.
I have three children waiting to start college. I can't afford to lose my practice.
Yeah.
Because I'm out there defending Joan of Arc.
There was a case when I first started doing this show, I did another show before this one, and the attorney took on this case pro bono. And she was working for this poor guy who had all kinds of medical problems. And the president walked into his townhouse, went through his closet, and told him to get rid of all his clothes that were over 5 years old, and went through his reading material and said he couldn't have all his reading material. The guy was in bed, and he had reading material on the floor next to him so that he could read while he was in bed. And he told him to get rid of it. When it got to court, she asked them, she put them on the stand and said, what is acceptable reading material? And they proceeded to tell her. The judge was horrified because he said, if I got rid of clothes that are over 5 years old, I'd be naked. I wouldn't have anything to wear. So the homeowner won. But what she told me was that they would come to her office. The association attorneys would come to her office and would threaten her. She was a sole practitioner, and they would threaten her. And
do all kinds of intimidation.
And they would tell her that if she didn't drop the case, or if she didn't do this, that, or the other.
Yes, I have experienced that dozens of times, where I've been threatened that if I don't drop the case.
Yes.
And with complaints made to the judge that I'm unreasonable because I won't drop the case for fraud.
Yes.
Or the case for theft. Or the case for... If I continue with zealous representation that I am unreasonable and will be referred for disbarment or for discipline or for sanction, and then when I was no longer an attorney, the threats still continue. What I'd kind of like to say about that is a project I'm working on right now, which is I believe that those threats made by an officer of the court who has a higher standard of behavior than a person who represents themselves, those threats are designed to intimidate. They are designed to harass. They're designed to try to make you fearful. And all of that is a pattern of civil rights violations. It's not just a mere violation, but it's discrimination when the court refuses to act on those kinds of statements and misbehavior by officers of the court. Now, to the extent that the judge goes along with it and involves and engages in it, so the name-calling or even the idea of having this person being allowed for whatever reason to walk into your home, whether they have a court order or they don't have a court order, or whether they make a discovery request. We want to see if this man is a hoarder, you know, because that would be a fire hazard and we can't have a hoarder in our community. Whatever excuse they come up with, you know, it's designed to minimize that man. It's designed to threaten him and intimidate him. And I believe that all of those actions, when they involve an attorney or a judge, and they're allowed and not sanctioned, that they are violations of federal civil rights, the 14th Amendment. Now, when they move to a higher scale, let's say that man was particularly adept at speaking, and he came on your show, Shoshu, that's cute. Anyway, if he came on your show and he spoke about it, and at that point the judge began finding him in contempt of court or punishing him in other ways or acting in a disparate and disproportionate manner in the courtroom because he's complaining about being harassed and having his civil rights violated, then I believe that we've reached the same. It's 1964 civil rights violations. It's the same thing that African Americans have been so successful in bringing civil rights lawsuits about, especially in the last 10 years or so. Way back when, in the 60s and 70s, when civil rights was first passed in 1972, they weren't that successful, but they kept bringing them and bringing them and bringing them. There was a plaintiff even before Rosa Parks sat on the bus, but she was determined not to be as sympathetic a plaintiff, and so they found Rosa Parks, who refused to move to the back of the bus. And the whole lunch counter movement, I think we have that now. As middle-class Americans, we have that kind of discrimination happening against us, where we're being treated and our civil rights are being violated. They're coming into your home. Even walking into your home, I don't care if they have an order or not. I think that order is probably a civil rights violation and deserves intense scrutiny on review to see if that was an illegitimate order. If they didn't have an order, however he talked his way into it, that man in particular needs to be sued for a civil rights violation. But also, had the man not won in court, I think that we need to start taking a really strong look at the attorneys who are making these threats and not just filing professional conduct complaints against them, but for calling it out for what it really is. And what it is civil rights harassment. And then if it reaches the higher stage, it's civil rights retaliation. Now, the trouble is those federal civil rights claims, courts don't like to hear them. And they have devised all different kinds of legal doctrines to keep people from filing these claims in court and having them heard. So you can go a whole lot of trouble and they'll say, oops, nope, you're the wrong class. It's not age. Oh, you know what? You're not old enough, or it's not sex, or it's not because you're a transgender person. If it was any of those things, you could sue, but it's not. It's just because you are an ordinary homeowner. You don't have a protected class. You don't have a special designation, so your civil rights and your constitutional rights, oh, so sorry, we can't hear your case. So that's in particular what I've been looking at developing by combing all of the discrimination cases and the civil rights cases, but especially the whistleblower cases, because I find that that's the transition where attorneys go from harassing litigants, or homeowners associations go from harassing litigants into retaliation against litigants, and that's more severe as a civil rights violation.
Now,
I wanted to use the federal acts because there's an economic disincentive with some of the newer, in the last 25 years, federal acts, there is a bonus to be had if you file a whistleblower claim.
Oh, really?
Really. Even age discrimination, if you file a whistleblower claim, you can get all of your attorney fees. So it encourages law firms who want to do this, who want to collect their fees, to handle your cases, although they don't especially want to work them all up. That's why I think if I can get into a position where I can help people work up their claims, they'll be able to shop for lawyers who will take them because they get attorney fees. But in addition to that, there are maybe four federal civil rights, federal acts that allow a bonus for whistleblowing. So you actually can recover multipliers of the cost, and hundreds of millions of dollars have been paid out as whistleblower bonuses over the last 10 years. Hundreds of millions of dollars to people who whistleblow.
Let me
if someone wants to go to California and draft a piece of legislation, I'd rather see them in D.C. trying to draft a piece of legislation that would allow ordinary people who are mistreated, harassed, and retaliated against in a court situation to recover this exponential. Otherwise, you can end up winning. Maybe you win against the judge, but all you get is a stay, or he has to stop doing that, but you don't get any money, and in the meantime, it's cost you $1 million to bring this lawsuit. So Americans say that they appreciate whistleblowers, but I think it's important for them to provide the benefits that allow people to whistleblow about corporations. There's something called the Frank Dodd Act that allows some corporations to be sued. If the Bar Association or the court organization could be seen as a corporation, as an entity which is incorporated, they perhaps could be sued under one of these reward statutes, federal statutes. But so far, there's no case in America that recognizes that.
Let me tell you about an experience I had with some people who, and we filed a complaint, a fair housing complaint.
Good.
And in the Fair Housing Act, at the end, it says no one can interfere with this press while the investigation's going on. The industry attorney, the attorney representing the association, intimidated the inspector and convinced her that she did not have the right to do this. HOAs were outside this. But then before waiting for the county to notify the homeowners that they had dropped the case, he sent her a letter and sent the homeowners a letter threatening them. And I said, all right, we're filing a complaint because he violated the law. He had no right to contact you. They were willing to take it against the association, but they said they never, ever file against the attorney, because if they do, he will lose his license and won't be able to practice.
Yeah, what's the point?
And I'm going,
and
yeah, exactly. And I said, well, wouldn't that be a good thing? You want him to continue doing what he's doing? So, yeah, they do not go after attorneys. They're immune from this nonsense.
Well, that was immune because the client wouldn't go after the attorney when they probably should have filed not only a professional conduct complaint, but they also have standing to sue that attorney for malpractice, even though they were on the opposite side. Who would guess? That attorney has errors and omissions insurance. You can sue that attorney for malpractice if it caused you harm and you're on the other side.
I keep learning from my guests.
Illegitimate act. Here, it was a threat. Plus, there was also the contact with the inspector, and I can't believe the inspector backed down.
The inspector didn't want to back down. Her boss did. He didn't want to do. You know, they just don't want to keep fighting these fights. I mean, it's just not worth their time.
And yet, what's the purpose of it? So my whole point about that is, if that were a federal civil rights claim, Fair Housing Act is perfect because you're not allowed to discriminate in housing. I'm uncertain as we sit here and speak today. Does Fair Housing Act have a reward provision for whistleblowers? Do you know, Shu?
I don't know. It's been a long time since I've actually sat down and read it.
To the extent that Congress is giving rewards for people who blow the whistle. Now, I think a lot of them go back to after the Civil War, the TAM claims, where the government would give 10% of whatever the reward was. Those kinds of lawsuits are still active, more popular than ever. So if you end up with, for example, a government contract where a corporation is selling toilet seats to the military and they're charging $10,000 per seat, and you are an employee and you turn your company in, you will get, first of all, you don't tell anybody about it. You contact an attorney and you file a a QI-TAM action, and you are entitled to 10% of whatever is recovered from the wrongdoing corporation. So if they're walking, if they're working off a $30 million contract, then that's a $3 million claim for you. I mean, reward system.
Carolyn,
kind of reward system set up
Carolyn,
for other kinds of whistleblowers as well.
We're out of time, Carolyn. we're out of time. You've got to come back.
Always. We always run out of time. I love talking to you, Shu.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for the opportunity. Appreciate it.
Please check out our website at onthecommons.us. On the Commons is produced by OTC Multimedia Productions.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Now there's lots of open meetings close to Justice 4HO. Those arrogant board members say what they want you to know. The CAI and ULI will help you lose it all. But I wouldn't sell that dream home yet, the writing's on the wall. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Well, we're not afraid or stupid, all your threats mean nothing here. Time marches on, soon you'll be gone, united we'll be there. So put your rules and CCRs up where the sun don't shine, and enjoy those precious golden years, stop messing around with mine. Those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell. Why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.